This Christmas, get ready for something truly magical as Yule Fest Kilkenny proudly presents the Irish debut of Starlight by Lux Morales, a 360-degree immersive light and sound show bringing you on a powerful journey into the heart of Christmas. For 8 spectacular nights from December 14th to 21st, the show will transform St. Canice's Cathedral into a breathtaking immersive world of sound and light. This is a Christmas event not to be missed. Tickets are selling fast, so get yours now at yulefestkilkenny.ie.
Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, Mission Impossible Final Reckoning. We find out if it justifies the hype, and a blockbuster of a different kind, the new Wes Anderson movie is here, the complicatedly named The Phoenician Scheme. So we find out if it's another home run for Wes Anderson. I also speak to the Italian filmmaker Alessandra Scilesi about her fascinating new documentary, The Flats, all about a tower block in Belfast. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Good weekend to you all, and I do hope you're doing well. Let's get straight into it. Dispense with my normal how's your father and simply say this week on TV, I was watching this.
Every day, he would come out and walk in the garden. Every day. We called him the pacer.
Using what's called mensuration, we see a person, the sun is shining this way, it casts a shadow, measure the size of the shadow, figure out the precise height of whatever's making the shadow. And the precise height was about the same height as Osama Bin Laden.
Literally, the hair on the back of my neck stood up. Oh my God. We may have found him.
Yes, now that is a member of the CIA talking about possibly finding Osama bin Laden. This is a documentary series. It's a three-parter, American Manhunt, Osama bin Laden, on Netflix. I was talking to Pat Kenny about this during the week, so I watched the entirety in about an evening. So first of all, to say this is obviously about the hunt for Osama bin Laden. This is quite jingoistic and obviously quite pro-American. It does ask some questions about Guantanamo and things like that. But be warned, this is quite pro-American. Now, that notwithstanding, most people agree Osama bin Laden was a pretty nasty character. So hunting him down seemed quite imperative. What makes this such a kind of gripping watch is that we are shown the horrors of 9/11 again in kind of a slightly new way that I hadn't quite seen. And we're given, you know, the footing of where America was, as in how desperate for revenge they were and how the CIA, in essence, became in charge of the hunt for bin Laden, as opposed to the American government or even Donald Rumsfeld at the time. It was kind of shopped out to the CIA because they claimed they could get him within weeks. Of course, it took over 11 years. What works in this documentary so well is that they have a lot of those CIA people. We see the many attempts to find bin Laden. We see how they, in essence, let him go in the hills of Tora Bora in Afghanistan because they didn't want to put ground troops in following an air raid. It was very strange stuff. But what really makes this so worthy of talking about is the last episode. It's an hour and 20 minutes. It's nearly feature length. And I'm not sure if I've watched anything as gripping on the TV in a long time. Even though we know what happens, they show you almost in real time the mission to get Osama bin Laden with Obama and his team and Hillary Clinton back in a situation room in the White House. SEAL 6 was the name of the team sent to get him in Pakistan. And they have one of those SEAL members, which is quite incongruous because you would think these people would not never want to be mentioned for very obvious reasons. But he's front and center in the last episode talking about the mission. It is gripping. You know how it ends, but it is tension-inducing TV. As I say, it's quite jingoistic in places, but it is a gripping record of the hunt for Osama bin Laden, as the name implies. It currently has a 100% rating on Rotten Tomatoes, and you can kind of see why, because in terms of something that is almost impossible to look away from when you're watching it. American Manhunt, Osama bin Laden on Netflix has that by the truckload. I'm highly recommending it as a watch, I have to say. Let me know what you might have been watching. John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. Now you're listening to Screen Time. And of course, the big new release of the week and possibly the summer is Mission Impossible Final Reckoning, which I think is the 8th movie in the franchise. I have seen it, but someone who will know the details more than I is Chris Wasser, arts critic and film journalist. Chris, how are you?
John, I'm very well. How are you?
Is it the 8th?
It's the 8th. And supposedly the final. Although depending on what time of the day you ask Tom Cruise that, there's a different answer, I think.
So I gather. So look, I have seen this. All 2 hours and 49 minutes of it, if I'm not mistaken, is the length of it. So to get people up to speed, Ethan Hunt is back for a final mission. And there is, people will know from the last movie, the Entity, which is this strange AI kind of machine who's developed consciousness who might end the world.
That's pretty much the Entity in one. And if you can explain the Entity, if you can explain the Entity in 5 seconds like that, then there's no need for the film to spend nearly 3 hours explaining it. And unfortunately, that's what it does. I mean, the last one was pretty straightforward. You know, like Mission Impossible films, plot-wise, you know, the stories are usually silly, but that's kind of what makes them special. But they're usually quite simple, easy to follow, and always come with, you know, bonus, additional, mesmerizing stunt work. But in the last one, yes, you had Tom Cruise, Ethan Hunt, chasing this bad guy named Gabriel, played by S.A. Morales, who, look, John, we won't overcomplicate matters, but let's just say that there was this gold key, which, you know, anybody who's in possession of this crucible key has control to the Entity, and they can either use it for good or for bad. And at the end of the last Mission Impossible film, you had Ethan Hunt finally in possession of this gold key, which means that at the beginning of this one, he's now something of a fugitive. You know, he's no longer, you know, the good guy at IMF, or at least as far as the, you know, the American authorities are concerned. He's someone who's in possession of the most dangerous thing on the planet. And for reasons that are never really fully explained, the planet is on the brink of nuclear war because Gabriel's still running around the place. For some reason, he doesn't need the key anymore. The US president is trying to bring in Ethan to, you know, hand over the key, but then she also gives him like 3 days to save the planet. You have various government officials voicing their concern. You know, people are saying, Ethan's too dangerous, it's his fault we're in this mess. And then you have other people at the table, and this is a very starry table. Like Nick Offerman is sitting at this table, Janet McTeer is sitting there, Angela Bassett is the American president, and they're all saying, no, give Ethan a chance, he is the only one who can save the day. So look, all I'll say is it's an extraordinarily complicated plot, but all listeners need to know is Ethan Hunt has a key and has the ability to stop nuclear war. Away we go.
Yes, and if any man can, it's probably Ethan. Let's be honest about it.
Yeah.
Angela Bassett, of course, playing the American president for the second time this year because she did so in Zero Day. Okay, so you're saying a few complicated plot issues, but on the whole, what did you make of this?
Oh, it's a mess. It really is. And you're speaking to, a huge Mission Impossible film fan. I love this series. And I do think that ever since Christopher McQuarrie, the director here, who started off his career as a screenwriter writing the Usual Suspects and has turned into one of the most bankable writer directors as a result of his relationship with Tom Cruise working in Hollywood today. And I think he's done phenomenal things with this saga. And I think ever since Fallout, so that's what, 2-3 Mission Impossible films ago, the boys have done a fabulous job together, making blockbusters the way no one else really makes blockbusters. You know, that reliance on practical stuff. Work, it just outshines anything Disney or Marvel are doing any day of the week. But here, I just think the mistake that the Final Reckoning, and I should say this is Dead Reckoning Part 2. For some reason, they've ditched the Part 2. And they've just decided to call it the Final Reckoning, presumably to get more bums in seats. This one makes the mistake of, as I said, over-explaining itself too much, but also taking itself too seriously. And the first hour here is unlike anything I've seen before, and I don't mean that in a good way. It sort of plays out like a glorified clip show. And you half expect Simon Pegg, and I should say I love these characters, Simon Pegg, Hayley Atwell, Ving Rhames, brilliant actors, brilliant characters, love them. But they're required to just keep telling you what's happening while it's happening. And you think, at one stage, I just thought one of them was going to say, previously on Mission Impossible, because for the first hour, John, you've seen it. You've got clips from all the different Mission Impossible entries. You've got you've got one too many pompous voiceovers, so many choppy cutaways, far too many MacGuffins, and you've got Christopher McQuarrie, who again, I usually like, but his confidence here, it's dangerous because he risks pulling a muscle trying to connect all the different Mission Impossible films together. And you're thinking there to yourself, the magic of these things is that they're episodic. You don't need to have watched, you know, the fourth one to understand what sort of bomb, you know, Ethan Hunt is holding in the eighth one. Like, we don't need a catch up. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, McQuarrie thinks we do. And it's just a mess. It's like, imagine, you know, you've got all of the greatest players in Hollywood lined up here. It's like watching a World Cup final, John, and someone's misplaced the ball. It's like,
no. Let me interject there for a minute. I know what you're saying about there was a lot of exposition and a lot of here's a movie or here's a clip from the second movie, here's one from the fifth movie. Yeah. That didn't weigh as heavy on me, but I completely get what you're saying. However, once the action kicked in, and there are two, without giving spoilers, one scene underwater, which I found quite pleasingly vertiginous, as in he's scaling kind of a sunken submarine, which was great. And then there is an air battle, which is pretty spectacular. So did you think this, and I'm putting words in your mouth here because this is what I thought, the second half got it back on track and got it the right side of good?
A little bit, but it still had, there were still one too many flaws. I think when Angela Bassett's US president comes in the second hour, she introduces this coherent plan. It's like, we need Ethan to save the day and we need you to do A, B, and C. And it's like, for the first time in 60 or 70 minutes, we finally know what's going on. But there's still too much. I mean, John, like I was joking during the week and saying that, you know, this film, you could start a drinking game around this film. And every time someone mentions the entity or explains who Gabriel is or what he wants, take a shot. But unfortunately, even the hardiest drinker would be hammered in no time. So it's still doing that thing of like telling you too much. Just show us. But the stunt work, some of it's quite entertaining. I think one of my favorite stunt sequences in the Mission Impossible saga was actually in Dead Reckoning, when you had Hayley Atwell and Tom Cruise handcuffed to the steering wheel of a yellow Fiat 500, zooming around the back streets of Rome, trying to, you know, dodge bullets and bystanders. Mm-hmm. That was just exhilarating. And then think also of, you know, the fight on top of the Orient Express, or even the film before, when Tom Cruise is being chased through Paris on a motorcycle. Yeah. That mesmerizing stuff, you know, put Tom Cruise as Ethan Hunt in a real world setting with real people around him, and it takes their breath away. Put him underwater chasing submarines by himself in muddy, murky waters. It's not quite as effective. I appreciate the effort that goes into it, but underwater sequences after 10 or 15 minutes, and that one goes on for longer, I think, they sort of lose their impact a little bit. Much better is the airplane sequences towards the end of the film. I mean, you know, you're watching this thing, John, and you know it's only a movie, and you know that Tom Cruise was really, you know, strapped to the side of these things, and there are safety harnesses, and they've all been, you know, edited out in post. Mm. But you know he's going to be okay, basically. That doesn't mean that your heart isn't in your mouth when you're watching them, and that I don't appreciate, again, the effort that's gone into this. So I like the stunt work, but I will ask you this, John. Do you understand fully why he needed to be hanging out of those planes? Because I think another mistake that this film makes is that the stunt work used to mean something. It used to be part of the plot. There was a reason why he'd be doing these things and risking his life. With this film, it never really explains why he needs to do those stupid things.
But with the airplane, and we're steering close towards spoiler territory, was he not pursuing Gabriel? Was that not the point? Because Gabriel had escaped in a plane, so he had to try and get in touch with Gabriel without saying any more. Was that not the basis?
He is chasing Gabriel, but I think, I don't want to say anything, but there's stuff around parachutes that I just thought, there are things that I won't spoil for people, but I was just a bit lost as to why he was doing these things. But, you know, I should say, look, it's impossible to give Mission Impossible, a bad review as far as I'm concerned. I still love this character, and I still think there's nobody else like Tom Cruise. I know he was joking about how he doesn't like being considered the last great movie star. In a sense, he really is. And I think that I'm on board with his commitment to his craft. I mean, yeah. You know, he believes everything that he's doing, you know, and he believes every overhead threat in this film, and he's so good. He convinces you of anything. If he started flying, John, without the assistance of any sort of aircraft, I believe him. That's how good he is, and that's how invested he is in these films. And that is a joy to watch someone so dedicated to their craft. Yeah. But I just thought this film was a little bit too messy for me.
It's funny, the last great movie star. It's almost like that phraseology. It's like an overdetermined event. It's like people are bemoaning that we're not losing great actors, but we're losing film stars, maybe. It's funny the amount that's being made of it. I will say one thing. Like, I don't know what work he has or hasn't done, but he's getting slightly older looking, but he still looks terrific. He
really does. It's the hair. I've talked about this a couple of times since.
You're quite definitive. Chris knows the secret.
I think it's the hair that makes him look. It's Tom Cruise with that sort of hair 20 years ago was quite cool. Tom Cruise with that sort of hair now, it kind of ages him a little bit. But at the same time, he does still look fantastic. He still moves brilliantly. You know, there is nobody else like him. But I would like, and again, I should say this, love this series of films. I am, in a sense, sad to see them go, but I'm excited to see what Tom Cruise does away from Ethan Hunt.
Yes, I completely agree with you. I mean, it's probably time to wrap it up, and we mean the franchise no disrespect by saying that, but it's fascinating. I'd love him to go and make another Magnolia now or something like that, you know? Okay, so what are you going to say stars-wise for Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning?
I think there will come a day when Tom Cruise and Christopher McQuarrie might ask themselves if, you know, ending the Mission Impossible saga with, like, you know, that murky deep sea dive or a convoluted AI threat, if that was the right way to go. And if they might have made things a little bit tighter, basically. But everyone here is great. The film at times looks fantastic. Did they spend too much on it? $400 million? Maybe. But again, like I said, I can't give one of these films a bad review. So I'm going to go with 3, but I'm also going to say to listeners, just, you know, not prepared to be disappointed, but just manage your expectations a bit.
Yeah, you see, I'm going to give it 3 as well, almost in counterpoint to everything you said.
Okay.
Because, I agree with all that you said, more or less, but it still kept me entertained for the whole time, more or less. The first half was far too long. It was too long generally, though. 2 hours and 49 minutes for what we saw was too long. But that said, I enjoyed it. I was entertained. I saw it. I can't remember when. It was last week sometime. And I sat there largely gripped, certainly for the second half, going, this is the magic of movie. So I'm going to give it 3 stars as well. We better give people a flavor of what we're talking about.
This can't all be true.
Every word. The CIA Black Vault break-in.
Am I reading this correctly? The Kremlin bombing?
In fairness, the bomb was actually meant to kill him.
He gassed a security briefing at the National Intelligence Directorate.
That was just 2 months ago. You two would have been in that meeting.
He arrived in the form of Mr. Kittredge's aide.
And left as Mr. Kittredge, I believe.
A clip there from Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning, which Chris and I both gave 3 stars to, even though we gave it kind of different reviews or similar reviews, but stuff bothered me less than it bothered him. But you know what? I'm dealing from a much lower base than he is. So something very different is a reworking of The Beloved. Is that fair to say? I'm not really sure. I'm not even sure if I've ever seen an episode or an iteration of Lilo and Stitch. But this is a live action remake of Lilo and Stitch, Chris, right?
That's pretty much it in one. I mean, you know, in some cases, scene for scene remake, except we are in the real world. Although, obviously, there is no such thing as a live action extraterrestrial, you know, blue furball named Stitch. So
that we know of as of yet.
Exactly. But you still have that problem of Disney trying to, you know, keep their live action films a little cartoonish. Do you have to have seen the original? You know, does that matter? I don't think so. This is just Disney kind of, you know, taking every film that they made either 20 or 80 years ago and seeing if they can get away with making
it. And the original, sorry, was the animated full-length movie, right?
It was, yeah. You had a guy named Chris Sanders who last year gave us the wonderful film The Wild Robot.
Oh, and, love that film, yeah.
Ah, gorgeous. I mean, that man seriously knows what he's doing. It's a case of he actually created the Stitch character in the 1980s, but he wasn't the Stitch character being, you know, again, this extraterrestrial furball who, when he gets to Earth, poses as a dog and is being chased by, you know, various different intergalactic space spies who want him back because he's very dangerous but also very intelligent. He actually didn't get his own film then until I think it was 2002, and the film was a huge hit and spawned, you know, various different spin-offs, direct-to-video sequels, television series. But again, this is the first time that you have a live action.
And, sorry to cut across you, a Disney ride, because I was on it in
about 20 years ago.
Very little, if memory serves. It was the lowest ebb of an otherwise lovely day in Universal or Disneyland. But I'm digressing wildly. Back to you.
Yeah, it's a simple. I won't be checking that out, John. But the Lilo and Stitch story, it's very simple. It's a version of E.T. in a way. You have Lilo, played by newcomer Maya Kealoha. She is the eponymous heartbroken Hawaiian orphan whose grown-up sister Nani, played by Sydney Agudong, is struggling to keep a roof over their heads. I think Nani has just turned 18, and she should be starting her own life and going away to college. But you know, she's now her younger sister's guardian. And it's a struggle. You know, there are various different job losses, bills are piling up, you've got social services on the doorstep. The last thing she needs then, John, is for this extraterrestrial Stitch, voiced by the franchise chief Chris Sanders, to show up and move in. And that's exactly what he does. Now, Lilo adores her little blue friend, but everyone else is horrified. Not so, like, you still get some people who genuinely seem to think it's a dog, but we'll just leave that. But nobody seems to notice the fact that there are bumbling alien spies around the place, played quite well, I thought, by Billy Magnussen and Zach Galifianakis. You have them at first playing these cartoon aliens, and then they find a way to make themselves human. So that gives those two comic actors a chance to just be, you know, silly versions of themselves, basically, for 2 hours. And they've been assigned by Hannah Waddingham's, her again, because she's actually in Mission Impossible 2. They've been assigned by the head alien, whoever it is, to capture Lilo and bring him home.
Okay, so far, very similar to the one back in the noughties, it sounds like, even though I can't remember ever seeing it. How does this pass mustard?
I think it's grand. Yeah, they can have that one for the posters if they want, because I've come across a few reviews there this week where you have people saying it's a travesty and it's just, it isn't a patch on the original and Disney shouldn't have touched this, and then you have reviews saying it's lovely, it's every bit as perfect as the original. The original wasn't perfect, there was something quite charming there, and this one isn't terrible. I think if you were to put it against other recent Disney live action remakes, Snow White for instance, or that ghastly Mufasa thing that we got before Christmas, this one is coherent, simple, fun, it has a heart, it'll do, I think. I know that doesn't sound great, but I had a better time here than I did with other Disney live action things. You also have a talented guy behind the camera, Dean Fleischer Camp. He's one of the brains behind the Oscar nominated Marcel Duchamp with Shoes On, which I loved. If you have not seen it,
it's gorgeous.
Rectify that now. It is. It's gorgeous. And I think, look, it's wholesome. It's breezy. It sometimes looks as if it's making itself up as it goes along. And I think maybe a little less copying would be nice, because at times I was like, oh, well, that's from E.T. That bit is clearly from Paddington. That bit is clearly Gremlins. It needs a few more original ideas of its own. But I thought that the Lilo and Nani pairing, I thought they were quite charming. I thought the whole stuff with Stitch was actually quite convincing. Some of the visual effects, had a bit of fun with Billy and Zach. I didn't hate it, John.
Okay, so you mentioned like The Wild Robot and Marcel would choose. This isn't destined to be a classic or anything like that. But it's, as you say, one, it's grand, as you say, one for the poster. So what would you say stars-wise for Lilo and Stitch?
It's kind of funny that Chris Sanders, who co-directed the original and created Stitch, and then Dean Fleischer Camp, they both have created far superior pieces of work. So I'm ending a review of a Lilo and Stitch film by saying, go watch The Wild Robot and go watch Marcel Duchamp with Shoes On. Say that 10 times fast. But at the same time, if you do find yourself at a screening of this film over the next week or two with younger viewers who will adore it, you won't, like me, hate it. I don't think it's a classic. I don't think it's a catastrophe. I think it'll do for now 3 stars.
3 stars for Lilo and Stitch, and also 3 stars for Mission Impossible: Final Reckoning. Chris, lovely to talk to you as always.
You too. Thanks, John.
Up next, a fascinating new documentary called The Flats, all about a group of flats in Belfast and the trauma within those walls.
This Christmas, get ready for something truly magical as Yule Fest Kilkenny proudly presents the Irish debut of Starlight by Lux Morales, a 360-degree immersive light and sound show bringing you on a powerful journey into the heart of Christmas. For 8 spectacular nights from December 14th to 21st, the show will transform St. Canice's Cathedral into a breathtaking immersive world of sound and light. This is a Christmas event not to be missed. Tickets are selling fast. So get yours now at yulefestkilkenny.ie.
Now you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. Now, opening this weekend in select cinemas is a fascinating new documentary called The Flats. Set in Belfast's somewhat infamous New Lodge, the well-known Catholic neighbourhood that was violently affected by the Troubles. Many of the men who lived there, who we encounter, were engaged in paramilitary activity in their youth and now suffer from, well, disillusionment and, it's fair to say, poor mental health. The film centres around a man called Joe, who's still very much traumatised by the murder of his uncle by the Shankill Butchers when he was just 9 years of age. And in The Flats, we see him reenact some of those memories, including attending the wake of his aforementioned uncle, feeling that he had to protect his granny, even though he was very much a child. There are also some fascinating women featured in this documentary who we feel are attempting to keep the community afloat. We come across a Jolene who's trying to ply her trade and advance her career as a singer while also bringing up her son, Sean. We also meet Angie, who's telling us the incredible story of, well, getting into some serious trouble with her abusive husband and minding something for the IRA. These stories are brought to life by us seeing some of the characters in therapy. And we see a therapist, Rita, sitting, listening to Joe talking about all these things. The Flats was directed by an outsider. And I use that term pointedly, as Alessandra Chilesi is originally from Italy, although she has a long association with Belfast. And she swore for a long time she wasn't going to make a documentary about the Troubles. And I'm delighted to say Alessandra joins me now. Alessandra, hello, how are you?
Hello, thank you for having me.
It's probably a question you're asked a lot. And I guess over here, we're obsessed with where people are from. But it does seem, I suppose, kind of strange that a person from Italy would make a documentary about New Lodge in Belfast. What drew you to this?
Well, if they were telling me someone from Italy was doing a documentary about New Lodge, I would be very suspicious. But I arrived in Belfast in 97 when I married a guy from Belfast. And actually, his dad's family is originally from New Lodge. So that's why I got interested in the area. And I had to say I waited 26 years before I dared to decide to film it, because I know how complex and how difficult it is to get to the bottom, to an area like that. So,
yeah. And sorry to interrupt, but your husband's father was from the New Lodge. And, you know, you don't have to get too personal, but from that, were you aware that the New Lodge contained a lot of traumatic stories?
Yes, I mean, unfortunately, they are everywhere in every family. You know, it was probably per square meter the place in Northern Ireland where they were more deaf because of the Troubles. So unfortunately, it's a very collective story. The army was based on top of those flats, so it made it even more difficult for the whole area. But they have something for them. They're extremely funny. They have this dark sense of humor that will get them through anything. And that's probably what fascinated me, because I thought we were going to be able to portray people that can stand despite all, and they can stand through their sense of humor, I would say.
I mentioned the three principal characters in it, Jolene, Angie, and Joe. They are incredible, and they seem incredibly willing participants. I mean, you're asking them to reenact difficult things. You're asking them to, you know, particularly in Joe's case, be in therapy on screen. Were they willing participants from the, I'm not saying you forced them into it, but I mean, did it take much talking to get them to agree to this? Because it's incredibly intimate.
It took time. You know, I knew that we had to get to that level of intimacy if we wanted to get and to touch something really true. So I took a lot of time. It took 7 years for the film from the first time I met them, from when I made it, you know. I wasn't there for 7 years with them, but I was there quite a lot. And I think over the time, we sort of grew together this idea, and little by little, they were basically directing themselves, you know, in the film, because they knew that was a unique opportunity to tell a story that was there in a wee drawer and needed to be told somehow.
With Joe, we see him sitting opposite this therapist, Rita, you know, and there's the old thing, as soon as you observe something, the thing you're observing is changed. And when you put a camera in front of someone, you know, there's a camera in front of them. So things are not maybe as objective as they could be. Yet when Joe is in therapy, talking to Rita about how hard life has been for him ever since he was 9 years of age and how seemingly lost he is now, it feels very real. But I mean, how real or not are those therapy scenes we see in your film?
Well, Joe was seeing Rita well before I started to film. You know, I always knew about this Rita. There was this Rita somewhere that was doing a lot of good for him. She's a befriender. She's not really a therapist. A befriender is someone who would, you know, just be there as if you go in a place where she works and you say, oh, I have a problem, I need to talk to someone. She would be there, like with no appointment, just available for that. And she's been seeing Joe for a long time. So I suppose they knew each other so well that when this crazy idea to film one of the sessions came along, it was like a continuation of their work, you know. And Rita said the fact that it was a camera and a crew and people really carefully listening to what it was saying, it gave like a safe place, a safe place where he could express himself with a lot of poetry, I find as well, you know. So Rita was like the key to this film for me, and it was an incredible collaboration.
Yeah. Now, as I mentioned, there are reenactments, and in particular, Joe and his neighbors go along with it, reenact his uncle's wake. I mean, I'm not saying you shouldn't have done it, but why did you want to do that?
I think I should not have done it, actually. I didn't even dare it to write it on paper for the producers, because it seemed a crazy, crazy idea. But I felt really strongly that we needed to see this past, because the past is so present in those flats that you can nearly touch it, you know. So I had this fantasy, this dream that we could bring it alive through reenactment. But these things only work if it works for the people that are involved. I must say there is a very strong tradition of political theater in Belfast that was a way the communities could represent themselves in a way that maybe media wouldn't represent them. So somehow I think I arrived in a place where that was a tradition that was there already. So to say, okay, you know what, we try to reenact this. It wasn't like a huge surprise. And I come from theater, so probably I was able to help them to go through that. And the secret, I'm going to be a bit of a spoiler, but the guy in the coffin is my son. So I offered my son as a proof that it was something really important for me, you know.
Yeah.
So he was doing the part of the uncle, the dead uncle. And I think that brought this family feeling of let's do this all together, because there is a strong meaning.
Yeah, wow. So you put your son in the coffin. Well, that is, you know, almost literally putting your money or your son where your mouth is. That's impressive. There are many memorable scenes in it. One that stays in my mind is Jolene is singing in various bars. And at one point, she's a gorgeous voice, but she shows up to this bar. She's taken her equipment out of the car herself. She starts to sing this very personal song, but yet there's cash registers binging, there's people ordering pints of beer, there's I think football or horse racing on the TV. Like, it's chaotic. And, you know, as an audience member, I was like, oh no, stop, get her out of here, get her out of here. Was that a difficult scene to film?
I think Jolien, unfortunately, she's very used to those situations. And yeah, I would say I totally can see myself in it, because coming from theater, I've been playing in places where nobody cares, you know. So I adore that scene for that, because it's someone with a pure heart with this her song trying to be heard and nobody cares. So, you know, it was difficult and not difficult because she's used. But I think what came with the film for her that was really important, it's she's always been singing, you know, songs from very famous artists, covers. But this time I asked her, do you want to write your own songs? Do you have something to say? So it was the first time she went through the process of writing or texts. And I was there to help her. And then our composer was there to help her to compose the music. So somehow she was able to be the soundtrack from inside the film, you know.
Let me ask you this, and there may be a simple answer to this. Is there any part of you, given the very complicated situation in Northern Ireland, that your film entirely, more or less, addresses the nationalist Catholic sense of the trauma, of the troubles, and there isn't really much mention of the other side, the Protestant Unionist side? I mean, we do see bonfires and huge bonfires, but it's all told very much from the traumatic side of a Northern Catholic nationalist. Like, is there any sense of you that thinks, I don't know, your next movie needs to be from the other side of the tracks, or maybe that isn't a concern of an artist, but you tell me.
Well, I think I didn't want to be politically correct. Not because mm-hmm. I stand more on one side or more on the other. If my father-in-law is from New Lodge, my mother-in-law, she's a Protestant. So, you know, okay. I stand on both sides. But I think there was not enough space in that film to film in both sides and say, oh, look, they are suffering the same on the other side. You know, it would have been probably just trying to be teaching children and not making yeah. a film. But I have to say, there is one peculiar scene where Joe, I don't know if you remember, Joe goes along saying a bit like randomly saying, oh, we all loved when we heard about soldiers being blown up. And that crossed the line so much mm-hmm. that I think that scene in itself says, oh my God, this is not right. So it's not, there's not one side who is right and the other side who is not right. You know, the line has been crossed
yeah.
many times on both sides. So I hope, and I actually, it's not only that I hope, because I've seen the film in Belfast with people from both sides. And I think it talks to everyone, because ultimately it's really about the internal trauma. It's true that it's seen on one side, but I stayed away from politics because also the politics here are so complicated to understand. Sure. So I just stick to the very wounded child that is Joe. And it could be a child on the other side, I would say, would be the same.
Absolutely. He certainly could. And I think those people have a lot more in common than was previously thought. But anyway, in closing then, one thing I noticed, obviously I'm from this island and I know Belfast reasonably well, but there are subtitles, and I needed the subtitles, even though, you know, I speak the same language as these people. Were you very keen that this might travel and that people were going to need subtitles?
Well, I knew that was the case. We had subtitles in Italian, in French. You know, the film traveled a lot. And even when we went to Australia, we went to England, and we needed subtitles. But I adore that, because I mean, I became a specialist in the Belfast accent. It took me a while, but now I go to England, I'm completely lost. We're in a new lodge and I understand everything. But I think they have a very specific way to talk, that they talk. You know, there's expressions that you could not invent them. They're,
yeah.
And it's such a pleasure to hear them and to hear them with that accent. And I always kept in mind during my shooting a film that is made by Luchino Visconti, who is an Italian famous filmmaker of neorealism time, you know, and he shot in this fisherman village in Italy where they spoke an Italian that was more like a dialect, you know. And that was like an incredible thing to do in those years where nobody would do that. And he had a subtitles copy going around Italy. It was a commercial failure, but the film is fantastic. And I think it's fantastic because it's their film, you know, from the eyes of a complete outsider. He was a very rich man. He didn't have anything to do with those people, but he gave them their film and their voice, and their voice had an accent. So I think that's what is really important about Belfast. If it has to travel with this accent.
Absolutely. Well said. And listen, The Flats, which is on release from this Friday, the 23rd of May, is an incredibly well-made documentary. I've been talking to its director, Alessandra Cilesi. Alessandra, lovely to chat to you.
Thank you very much.
One thing I want rid of in my life is the pain and the hurt and the men that have hurt me.
My God, the gate's locked. For God's sake.
Seriously, like, why is that locked? Just because of the bonfire?
That's a nice little flag they're burning.
See the black guy? I was awful good at makeup, do you think?
I need someone to protect me.
Do you want to be happy?
Yes. I don't know where the light is at the end of it. I can't see the light.
This has went from a ghetto to a slum.
Do you think I'll be able to get out of here, Jim?
Yes. Go as far away from here as you can.
A clip there from The Flats, which is on select release from this Friday, the 22nd of May. And you heard me talking there to its director, the Italian-born Alessandra Cilesi. Up next, the return of Wes Anderson. Now you're welcome back to the last part of Screen Time. Now, outside of Mission Impossible and indeed The Flats and Lilo and Stitch, is a blockbuster for a certain type of movie fan, the new Wes Anderson movie, The Phoenician Scheme, if I'm not mistaken. It keeps confusing me, that title. Delighted to be joined now by entertainment journalist and all-round movie critic, let's call her, Dee Mullumby. Dee, how are you?
Thanks so much for having me, John. Gosh, it's such a stellar week at the movies, isn't it?
I was not bemoaning, but I thought it was strange that Wes Anderson, Lilo and Stitch, Disney would want to go up against Mission Impossible. Like, it seems kind of strange that they didn't hold the release for the following week or a previous week.
Yeah, it's a funny one, but I suppose this is what you get. You get these kind of weeks where you have, you know, counter programming because you're not going to have the same audience going to any of those movies. So really, aren't they in direct competition? So that's what you'd wonder, you know?
Yeah, maybe that's, and also they can probably blame it if they have a bad book on, you know. So listen, are you a Wes Anderson fan?
I am, I would say. Yeah. I wouldn't say I'm a diehard fan. I wouldn't have been as much of a fan of his earlier works like The Royal Tenenbaums, which I know you're a fan of, Don, so I apologize in advance.
It's okay. I need you to stay.
Yeah. But I do remember even like, you know, growing up and seeing like the life of, you know, the Life Aquatic, which I really enjoyed. Moonrise Kingdom. I'd say my very, very favorite though is Isle of Dogs. I just think that's just the sweetest movie.
It is a great movie. The Royal Tenenbaums is probably my favorite movie of all time. So we better move on. The Phoenician Scheme. My good friend Bobby Kerr always says you've got to have a nice title for a business or a movie. This is quite confusing because it's PH, Phoenician, right?
Yeah. Okay. It's a weird one. And it's funny actually that you mention a business or a movie because this is kind of a businessy movie, so it makes perfect sense.
Okay, so what's going on in the Phoenician scheme?
Yeah, so we are following a wealthy businessman named Zaza Korda, played by Benicio del Toro. He has just survived another assassination attempt at the very start of the movie. He's walking away from like a plane crash type of scene. So he's realized that, you know, I need to kind of start, you know, lining up stuff for like later on in life. So he basically appoints his only daughter, who is a nun in training named Liesel, played in the film by Mia Threepleton, as sole heir to his estate. And the film basically follows them, I suppose, bonding and going about, you know, setting up kind of deals for these various projects that will eventually make up the Phoenician scheme.
Right. And there are lots of cameos, extended cameos. I mean, this guy is like, it's not the best analogy. People don't appreciate this, but he is the Woody Allen in terms of who he can get. Tom Hanks is in here, Scarlett Johansson, Benicio del Toro. Like, there are so many actors. Benedict Cumberbatch is in there.
Bryan Cranston. And then a lot of kind of the regulars who we'd associate with like Wes Anderson movies. You've got like Willem Dafoe, F. Murray Abraham and Bill Murray. They would have worked with him a few times at this stage. Scarlett Johansson as well. The list just goes on.
I know, it's pretty incredible. So one of the motifs in his movie is bad dads. And maybe that's why so many men of my generation with daddy issues love him so much. But Benicio del Toro, is he a bad dad in this?
I suppose it's kind of up to yourself by the end of the movie, but I found him a really intriguing kind of character here. Like, what I always find with Benicio del Toro's performances, and I hope that it's not just me, I think he does have this like natural sense of menace. I don't know what it is about the guy, but somehow it ends up working quite well actually in this film, because I think it means that there's always like some kind of bit of like intrigue surrounding the character. You're not sure exactly what he's about, and that really does keep you kind of hooked in. But what's interesting as well is that he's a character that has a lot of bravado. I would say he almost has like a George Clooney-esque type of cheekiness. Like, I was reminded of kind of Fantastic Mr. Fox or something here in kind of his lead performance. But I thought that he was great in that, like, he fits the bill for a Wes Anderson lead, but he's kind of bringing something a bit his own as well. So I quite enjoyed him as the lead, I have to say.
And his daughter is Mia
Threepleton. I'm Threepleton, not 100% how you pronounce it, but I mean, my understanding is this is kind of her first like big role.
And she's pretty good by all accounts.
I thought she was brilliant. Yeah. Because, I mean, she's kind of the way into the story, and she's kind of like the straight-laced character, I suppose, among all the like madness going on around her, which is funny because she is a nun in training, which isn't exactly conventional. But yeah, she's a lot of fun in this movie. I felt very connected to her. I thought that she was very sweet, very likable, very charismatic. She has this kind of relationship with her nine adopted brothers in that, you know, she's kind of asking her father, like, why are you leaving the estate to me? Like, you have all of these sons, and he's like, well, they're all adopted and they're too young, and you know, they're having this conversation, and the sons are like shooting arrows down at them while they're trying to have this conversation. And Benicio del Toro's character is like, yeah, that's why I think that it's best that you take this on a bit more mature.
And does this all take place in kind of a land that doesn't actually exist?
Yeah, it's a weird kind of one. And I know that, and that was one thing that I was kind of struck by watching this movie, because I know that in the past, even with a movie like Isle of Dogs, that Wes Anderson can kind of toe the line a bit when it comes a bit to like cultural appropriation, and you're like, exactly where is this place meant to be? It's kind of a fantastical world, and yet it's kind of adapting all of these characteristics of these other countries. So I wasn't sure if I was exactly kind of on board with that. And to be honest, like, I did kind of notice a few other like flaws in this movie. Like, for example, there are these cutaways to this boardroom of kind of scheming tycoons who are led by Rupert Friend's character, who is known as Excalibur.
Rupert Friend is in it as well.
Good Lord. and he would have there you go, another star, and he stars in the Wes Anderson short films. If you've never seen them on Netflix, they're absolutely fantastic, look them up. But there are also these like black and white like dream sequences whenever like Zaza has these kind of near death experiences, and for me, they never, those kind of cutaway scenes, they never quite fit into the main storyline, and I was always just eager to kind of get back to the relationship between father and daughter and stuff like that. So I'm not sure if those always work.
So brass tacks time. It was it an enjoyable trip to the cinema, or how did you find it overall?
Yeah, I mean, if you're a Wes Anderson fan, I definitely think you'll enjoy it. I was kind of watching it wondering if there was quite enough unique to it for anyone to like watch it and say this would be my Wes Anderson favourite movie. But you know, he has like had a bit of a run of not so great movies lately, like The French Dispatch and a watch him call it Asteroid City. I don't think were as great, but I think this is Wes Anderson back to his usual stuff. So it's good. It's a good movie.
So I'm a massive fan, but those two movies you mentioned, I just felt were too Wes Anderson-y. Like, yeah, he'd reached peak Anderson and the style had overtaken a story, which is what everyone wants. Mm-hmm. Is this movie guilty of that?
It's still definitely very Wes Anderson-y. Okay. I mean, like, you have to go into it knowing it. It's like full of whimsy. You've got your stylistic square framing in there, the like plenty of moments of like dry humor and like zippy editing. Like, it's very much a Wes Anderson movie. So if you're not into the guy, do not go to this movie.
So this is your first time on Screen Time, by the way, talking to Dee Malumbi. What's your star rating out of five?
I'm going to give it 3.5 out of 5.
Okay.
Yeah, and it doesn't overstay its welcome as well. I think that it clocked in at about 100 minutes, which was just the right amount. It's an enjoyable movie. I like it.
Okay. This is the first time in a long time I haven't gone out the week of a new Wes Anderson movie to see it, but that's more to do with time. But I'm very much looking forward to this. Dee Malumbi gives it 3.5 stars, so it will certainly keep the Wes Anderson fans happy. Dee, I'm happy you came into studio. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
I've appointed you sole heir to my estate, which you may come into sooner rather than later, and provisionally manager of my affairs after the event of my actual demise on a trial basis.
Why?
Why what?
Why sooner rather than later, since you survived again? And why am I sole heir to your estate? You have 8 sons at last count.
9 sons.
9 sons. What about them?
They're not my heirs.
Why not?
I have my reasons.
Which are what?
My reasons? I'm not saying. I'm saying I'm not saying.
A clip there from the Phoenician scheme. The title confuses me, but I confuse easy. That is it for this week. Next week on the show, I'm going to be talking to Gillian Anderson. Yes, about the new movie, The Salt Path. All of that to come in the next week. In the meantime, if you want to get in touch with me at any stage, John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can, of course, email us, screentime@newstalk.com. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. I'm about to catch a flight to Japan. I will tell you more about that next week. Thank you for listening. Take care and enjoy the rest of your weekend.